Mr. Butler, you might want to increase your volume a little bit. I think we're having a little difficulty hearing you.
Okay.
Our next case is the State of Minnesota versus Lichness. The file number is A20-0108. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes. And then finally, appellant's counsel will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So whenever you're ready, just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Okay, Your Honor, may I ask, can you hear me better now?
A little bit.
Okay, let's try that.
That's a little better.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Benjamin Butler, and along with my colleague, Davie Axelson, we represent the appellant, Larissa Lichness. Our legislature says what it means and means what it says. And it wrote a statute in this case that requires the state to prove that the defendant acted with intent to defeat the purposes of the public assistance statutes listed and then joined with the conjunction and. This means the state has to prove the defendant acted with the specific intent to defeat the purposes of all of those statutes on the list. And the legislative history confirms that that is what the legislature intended, because the legislature in 1999 took a list that was disjunctive and made it conjunctive when it amended the statute to replace an or with an and. The state doesn't even try to argue that Ms. Lichness had such intent to defeat the purposes of all of those statutes. Even if the court were to conclude that she only needs the intent to defeat the purposes of the programs in which she was enrolled, this evidence is still insufficient to prove even that. In the alternative, the jury instructions were plainly erroneous because the jury instructions did not reference this clear and simple intent requirement in any way, and therefore were missing an essential element of the crime. And for either or any of those reasons, we ask this court to reverse Ms. Lichness's conviction. The statute uses plain and simple terms to describe one of the two mental states required to prove this crime. It uses the word and, which is unambiguously conjunctive, to join the statutes in the list in what is what I'll refer to as the flush paragraph of subdivision one. There is plenty of case law from this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court holding that when multiple items on a list are joined by the conjunction and, the statute requires all of those items to be satisfied in order for the statute to be satisfied. And those examples are, some examples are listed on pages 14 and 15 of our brief. You combine the conjunction and with the use of the plural word purposes, also in the flush paragraph, you have an unmistakable sense from the legislature that it wants all of those statutes, the purposes of all of those statutes, to be defeated. The word purposes, plural, acknowledges that...
Isn't the purpose of all of those statutes to provide assistance for the poor?
That might be the general purpose of public assistance statutes, Your Honor, but each one of those statutes has a very specific purpose. And we know this by looking at the chapters that are listed in the statutes. Chapter 256B, 256D, and 256J, just to take the ones that Ms. Lichness was involved in, at the start of each chapter have a specific policy or purpose section passed by the legislature. And those purposes are much more specific than just helping people. 256J, for example, lists the purpose as implementing a federal block grant program called the Temporary Assistance with Needy Families, or TAMF, which provides cash assistance for a limited time with families with children and to pregnant women. So there's something both broader and more specific about each one of these programs.
And if as to that statute then, how would you propose that the state prove the intent under that statute? What would they have to do, and what would the jury instruction have to say?
Well, the jury instruction, I take your last question first, Your Honor. The jury instruction would simply say what the statute says, which is the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant didn't act with the intent to defeat the purposes of the statutes. That's a plain and simple instruction to write. How would the state do that? I would suggest that the court can look to Kindheart for that. The state could call a social worker or a program administrator from the county, whoever administers the program. That witness could testify to the specific purposes behind each one of the programs at issue, each one of the programs listed in the statute, which is our primary position, or each one of the programs that the defendant was involved in, if the court wants to focus on that. And then prove intent the way it always proves intent, which is with circumstantial evidence of what the defendant did and why and how she might have done it. If you look at Kindheart, for example, the state in that case, or the government, whatever you want to call them, the state proved that the defendant knew, this is at page 13 of the Kindheart opinion, the state proved that the defendant knew, quote, that the program in which she was enrolled, that's my ad, that the program depended on accurate billing by child care providers, end quote. So the provider in Kindheart knew more than just that she was getting money that she wasn't entitled to. She knew something broader. She knew that by doing that, that she was putting the program at issue at risk. And that is what the Supreme Court said proved for the sake of that administrative proceeding, that she intended to defeat the purposes of the program. And I think backing up to Kindheart is important because Kindheart really does settle at least part of the question here as to what the intent requirement is. The state says the intent requirement is simple intent to defraud, and that is simply not consistent with Kindheart. It's also not consistent with the plain language of the statute, which does not say intent to defraud, which the legislature knows how to write. But in Kindheart, the Supreme Court makes clear that the intent requirement is the intent to defeat the purposes of at least the program in which the defendant is enrolled. It's our position that the intent requirement is actually broader than that. It's to defeat the purposes of all of the programs on the list joined with AND. But even if it's just the intent to defeat the purposes of the programs in which the defendant is enrolled, again, the state didn't prove that because unlike in Kindheart, there's no evidence.
How would you prove, let's say taking your argument that they have to intend to defeat the purposes of all of the statutes. If they've only receiving assistance under one statute, how would the state prove that?
They probably couldn't. They probably couldn't. But that doesn't mean it's not a crime. That does not leave this. That does not leave people free to defraud the government. I think if so, if what you're asking, Your Honor,
if they're only taking assistance under one statute.
Yep.
But your argument is that, you know, it says what it says, so they have to prove intent to defeat all the purposes. Then as long as you're involved, as long as you get assistance under one program and not the others, you can do as much as you want to defraud and you'll always be acquitted because it says all three or all five.
Yeah. You might be acquitted of this crime because you haven't committed this crime. Now, if the state charged you with, say, theft by swindle, you might not be acquitted, because if you have lied to the government in order to receive money, then you've probably committed a theft by swindle, and that's how most things like Medicaid fraud is charged. Or you could have just committed a simple theft if you have access, have wrongly obtained access to somebody else's property, including the government's money. There are any number of crimes that the government could charge you with. But I agree with you that this statute, because of how it's written, is not going to apply to that many people. Might not apply to anybody in the state of Minnesota right now. But
so isn't that an absurd result then? If you have a statute that has no applicability to anybody?
No, it's not an absurd, for several reasons, it's not an absurd result.
Isn't your interpretation of it, doesn't that lead to an absurd result?
Well, Your Honor, it's not my interpretation of it, it's what it says. That is the plain language of the statute.
Right, I understand that. But let me ask you this, Mr. Butler. So would you agree that the specific governs over the general?
In general, where there's a conflict between two statutes that cover the exact same conduct and have the exact same elements, yes.
Well, I think it actually is broader than that. I appreciate your example, but I think generally you have the specific language of a statute governs over the general, and generally, to every rule there's an exception. I agree with you there. The general statement is the what you call kind of the flush paragraph here, right?
I'm not sure what you mean by general statement, Your Honor. I don't follow the question.
Sure, not a problem. I'll be more specific. So in subdivision one, it says a person who commits any of the following acts with intent to defeat the purpose of the sections. I think you refer to that as the flush paragraph.
Yes. Yep, okay. I'm with you.
Okay, so and that's what I mean. That seems to me to be the more general statement of what it's outlining what's going on here, right? And when we look under clause one, that's the more specific. And there it talks about obtaining or attempts to obtain by means of willfully false statement or representation by intentional concealment of any material fact. And then it talks about the statutes that it could, and also talks about it in the conjunctive there, and Minnesota Care Services. But then it says, the very last portion says, to which the person is not entitled. So that seems to consistent with your interpretation of the other case where the intent is to defeat at least the program in which the defendant is enrolled, that seems to support the a different interpretation that those programs are listed in the conjunctive just to list all the different programs that could apply, but then that to which the person is entitled says, well, of course you can't be charged with violating a program in which you're not enrolled. So why isn't that a reasonable interpretation?
I don't think it's reasonable, Your Honor, because it ignores the and.
The and is put in the context of grouping all of the different programs together that a person could potentially violate.
I think you have to take a step back, Your Honor, and look at what the statute is doing. So what the parent one is actus reus of the crime. The actus reus of the crime is obtaining by willfully false statement or intentional concealment money that you're not entitled to. That is the act. That's the actus part of the crime. There's two mens rea parts of the crime. The first is in the flush paragraph. Because it says a person who commits any of the following acts or omissions. By the following acts or omissions, they're talking about the parentheticals that follow 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. Those are the acts. So acts or omissions, then it says with intent to defeat the purposes. So that's mens rea number one. You have to act, and with intent to is a really key phrase here, because that's like one of the magic phrases the legislature uses when it wants to convey criminal or specific intent is an element of the crime. That's from 60902. So with intent to defeat the purposes of, and then it lists all the statutes joined by and. That's mens rea number one. And mens rea number two is found in the actus reus paragraph. You have to have an intentional concealment or a willfully false statement. Not a lot of crimes have two mens rea requirements, but this one does, right in the language of the statute. And so I think to sort of fold those two paragraphs together into a single mens rea, I think that doesn't work under the language of the statute. If they wanted one mens rea, they would have said that. They could also say, this comes back to a little bit what was argued in Malik, which doesn't seem to be the state's position here, which is that first paragraph is sort of a meaningless introduction or setting the tone for what we're about to talk about here. And that's also not true. The legislature sometimes does that. I mean, those purpose paragraphs that I referenced in 256 B, D, J, and K, and L are all those kind of things. But here, the legislature didn't say, like, the purpose of this statute is to protect public assistance or something like that. It started codifying the crime right away in the flush paragraph and used phrases like with intent to, which are signals that it is codifying a mental state. With intent to do what? Defeat the purposes. The purposes of what? All of these statutes. And if you look at the 1999 amendment, you can see that what they did up until 1999, that list was disjunctive. it was confusing at times, and sometimes it had it wasn't 100% clear, but it sure looked disjunctive, and it had a couple of ors in it. In 1999, they took out the or and they added the and. And then in 2015, when they added another program, they added another and. They wanted that list to be conjunctive. Why did they want that list to be conjunctive? To Judge Connolly's point, is that the best policy decision for that list to be conjunctive and make it really hard for the state to prove the crime? Well, that's up to them. That's up to the legislature. That's not up to any of us. And so that's their policy decision. And because they made that policy decision, they made it very hard for the state to prove this crime. And they certainly didn't prove that Ms. Likeness committed it. And so we'd ask you to reverse her conviction. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Butler. We'll now hear from the state, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, and may it please the court, my name is Ed Stockmeyer. I'm an assistant attorney general appearing this morning on behalf of respondent, state of Minnesota. The public assistance fraud statute requires proof of the type of intent that we ordinarily associate with fraud, the intent to defraud. The state must prove the defendant made a knowing deception and did so for the purpose of obtaining benefits she knew she was not entitled to obtain. Appellant's contrary interpretation of the public assistance fraud statute is actually pretty remarkable. According to appellant, the legislature intended the state to prove that the defendant acted with the specific intent to undermine the purposes of a wide variety of different statutes, including those statutes which no longer exist and statutes which have nothing to do with the program the defendant actually defrauded. And this morning, my friend has come quite close to asserting that the legislature intended to draft a statute that has no applicability to any defendant whatsoever. I think that's remarkable, and I think we can all agree that at the very least, it's a counterintuitive interpretation of a criminal
statute. Well, you know, Mr. Stockmeyer, I live in a city where a majority of the elected officials seem to think the best way to fight crime is to do it without police. So who knows what the legislature intended? I mean, at the end of the day, you know, I've always been a great believer, and it's like, you know, it says what it says, and that seems odd, but, you know, many things are. And wouldn't this be the time to say, you know what, this seems odd, but that's what it says. You know, we presume ambiguities against the drafter, and we certainly don't presume ambiguities in favor of people we're sending to prison. So reversed, and hopefully then at the next session, maybe they'll put the oars back. I mean, why isn't that the best result here? Hold them to what they passed.
So two responses to that, Your Honor. First, you raised, I think, a question of lenity, and I just want to be clear. The Minnesota Supreme Court has been very clear that lenity is the last canon of construction we reach. We've got to exhaust all the others before we get there. It basically has to be a statute that we simply can't interpret, and then lenity applies. But to the substance of your question, I don't think that this is that the statute clearly means what my friend says that it means. I do agree that my friend presents one plausible textual reading of the statute, but it is not the only plausible textual reading of the statute. And I want to point this court specifically to the word purposes. And our interpretation of the strict language is that the word purposes here refers not to the specific purposes of each individual program, such that the state must prove the defendant intended to defeat the purposes of program X, intended to defeat the purposes of program Y, intended to defeat the purposes of program Z, etc., but rather refers to the general purposes behind this collective set of public assistance programs. You could say that it is the purposes that are common to all of these programs. And those are things like to ensure that needy families are able to meet their basic needs, to ensure that our neighbors can live with dignity. And those are the general purposes that the statute is referring to. What the state has to prove is intent to defraud. And that is because intent to defraud as a matter of law demonstrates that the defendant has intended to undermine those general purposes. When the state proves that a defendant made willful, deceptive statements or omissions and did so for the purpose of removing money from these programs, which they know serve these more general abstract purposes, the state has, as a matter of law, proven that the defendant intended to defeat the purposes of those programs. You simply can't say a person didn't have that purpose if they were acting with intent to defraud. And that's sort of our general textual argument. But if you don't believe me about, or if I don't convince you on our textual argument, the Minnesota Supreme Court has already addressed how to interpret this statute. We have three separate cases where the court has applied the statute. In Ibarra, the first one, the court laid out the elements of public assistance fraud. It said the crime consists of obtaining assistance, the defendant's knowledge that, she is not entitled to that assistance, and a false representation the defendant makes for the purpose of obtaining the assistance she's not entitled to receive. So that's really intent to defraud. And then in Hill, the Supreme Court specifically cited Ibarra in saying the statute requires proof of intent to defraud. And then in the Kind Heart daycare case, we have what I think is really the Supreme Court sustaining really a prototypical example of intent to defraud. You had a provider who submitted false billing statements in order to receive benefits the provider was not entitled to. That's just intent to defraud. And so I don't think Kind Heart Daycare really does anything else than that. So we have these three Supreme Court cases. They're all about intent to defraud. And so regardless of what we think about what the statute's language means today, if we were reading it on a blank slate, we're bound by what the Supreme Court has said. And that is really the rule of law here. The public assistance statute requires proof of intent to defraud because that's what the Minnesota Supreme Court has said. And based on that precedent, this court should affirm because the state proved that Ms. Likeness intentionally made deceptions for the purpose of obtaining assistance she was not entitled to receive.
I agree with you. Ibarra seems to be most helpful to the state, but you know, does that depend on, however, on what statute you're reading? I mean, and is the statute in this case different from the statute in Ibarra?
My recollection was it was the public assistance fraud statute. Now, of course, the 256.98, the statute has changed since then. But again, our position is this case is really about the word purposes in the statute, and the statute has always included the language with intent to defeat the purposes of, and then some enumerated list of more than one public assistance program. And so that has always been the requirement. And so when the court addressed the statute in Ibarra, it was really addressing the same language that's in question here. My friend has made argues at length about whether the statute is conjunctive as it is today or disjunctive as it has been in the past, but I don't think that matters because let's say, for example, we still had the statute that used to be disjunctive. Then the statute would say the defendant has to act with intent to defeat the purposes of program X, program Y, or program Z. And under the strict language of that, you could argue that in a case involving SNAP benefits alone, the state could decide to prove the defendant intended to defeat the purposes of, for example, the medical assistance program. And that would satisfy the language of that disjunctive statute. I don't think that's right. And so I don't think the heart of the statute should really be whether it's just disjunctive or conjunctive. It's about what does the word purposes mean. And one of the main problems with appellant's argument is that he really never identifies what he thinks the work that the word purposes is doing in this statute. I think this morning we got some clarification when my friend referenced these precatory parts of these statutes, which lay out sort of general purposes. But I'd like to point this court to page 18 of appellant's principal brief. He cites one of these general purpose subdivisions, and it's specifically cites to section 145.88 subpart 2. as identifying the purpose of the program encapsulated in that statute. But if you look at the wrongfully obtaining assistance statute and you look at what subdivisions are actually cited there, it does not include 145.88. The range of statutes is 145.891 to 145.897. So even under my friend's reading, there is a need to look beyond the strict language of what we have in the statute in order to know what the word purposes means. And I think that just goes to show that there is ambiguity in this statute, and we need to do more than...
Yeah, Mr. Stockmeyer, sorry to interrupt you there, but I just wanted to make a few comments and questions. And actually, you're leading right to it with respect to ambiguity. And you question your friend's interpretation of it, but it seems to me that Mr. Butler's interpretation is a reasonable one based on the plain language of the statute. Would you agree that that is actually a reasonable interpretation?
I guess I would call it a textually plausible interpretation, Your Honor. In other words, I think it makes sense of the literal words that are written, but it's not a reasonable interpretation if we think about, well, what does that actually mean? But it is textually plausible. But
okay, well, if it's not a reasonable interpretation, then there's no ambiguity. In order for there to be ambiguity, there have to be two reasonable interpretations. And it seems to me that Mr. Butler is onto something in terms of interpreting that flush paragraph based on the plain language and the conjunctive and
our alternative reading, Your Honor, really focuses on the word purposes. And that is, again, that the word purposes is referring to the general purposes underlying this entire set of enumerated statutes.
So okay, fair enough. So how do you interpret the term and, particularly given, let's assume for the sake of argument that the statute is ambiguous, that your interpretation and appellant's interpretation are both reasonable interpretations. Let's just assume that for now. How do you get around the conjunctive and, particularly given that the legislature changed it from the disjunctive to the conjunctive?
Your Honor, the way I would read it is the statute says the state has to prove the defendant intended to defeat the general purposes of programs X, Y, and Z. The and supports our reading of this being about general, broader, more abstract purposes of providing assistance. They are the purposes common to all of these programs. And so whether it's, I think that's our reading there is really, it doesn't really matter whether it's conjunctive or disjunctive. It is the purposes underlying all of these programs. And again, as I said earlier, those are things like to provide funds to needy families, to ensure that our neighbors are able to live their lives with dignity and the like. And our position is that when the state proves a defendant has acted with intent to defraud, as a matter of law, they have proven that that defendant intended to defeat the general purposes of providing public assistance. And unless the court has any further questions, I would simply ask that this court affirm Ms. Likeness's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stockmeyer. Mr. Butler, you'll have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honors. Respondent has focused a lot on the phrase intent to defraud today. The phrase intent to defraud does not appear in the statute, and the phrase intent to defraud does not appear in Kind Heart Daycare. You can do a Control F word search. I just did. It's not in there. And the reason is because that's not the intent element here. It's not the one we're talking about. Kind Heart Daycare says, quote, as to intent under the latter statute, meaning the one we're talking about, to defeat the purposes of, and then it ellipses, child care assistance programs. That is the intent element the state has to prove under the flush paragraph, at least to defeat the purposes of the specific program in which the defendant was enrolled. And the plain language would indicate to defeat the purposes of all of those programs.
If that's the case, you know, to defeat the purposes of that, you know, program, then presumably you could be prosecuted. I mean, and if the intended purpose of the program is, you know, to give people assistance so that they can buy food to give it to their children, okay, let's just say that's one of them, then if it's not intent to defraud, then presumably if a person enrolled in that program got the assistance and threw the food out rather than giving it to their children, they could be convicted under this statute under your definition, because they would be intending to defeat the purpose of it, which is to give food to their children. And they didn't do that, they threw it out.
I think, Your Honor, they couldn't be convicted because they haven't committed the actus reus of the crime, which is receiving benefits to which they're not entitled. So the state would flunk paren one under your hypothetical, even if they could meet the flush paragraph. I think the references, to answer Judge Connolly's question about what statute are we looking at in Ibarra, it is a very different statute. It is a pre-1999 version of this statute. Ibarra doesn't help answer this question here. The state talks a lot about general purposes, that what this language is really getting at is the intent to defeat general purposes. A, of course, that's not what it says. And B, to the contrary, the statute, as counsel discussed, lists very specific numbers, statutory numbers, defeat the purposes of sections 145.891 to 145.897, comma, and then a bunch of other stuff that sounds like that. Now, that doesn't sound very general to me. That sounds extremely specific. And so if the state's going to fault our brief for citing 898 instead of 897, and then come back and say, well, all the state really has to prove is general purposes, that seems counterintuitive. The state has to prove exactly what the statute says the state has to prove. And this comes back to Judge Connolly's question to me earlier. This is what it says. It's not ambiguous. The state makes no argument that under the plain language of the flush paragraph, they met their burden. None. They have to get to ambiguity. And then to get to ambiguity, they have to change some words. And then they have to change the intent requirement to one more general, like intent to defraud, in order to prevail here. And that's just not, that's too much violence to the plain language of the statute. Yes, Your Honor.
What do you see in the flush paragraph? What do you see as the purposes when it talks about with intent to defeat the purposes of these various programs?
What are the purposes, Your Honor? Is that the question?
Yeah. Yes.
Sorry. Each one of these statutes has a purpose provision, or at least several of them do. 256B, D, J, and L all have purposes statutes that are given by the legislature. If we're talking about 145 and 256K, 256K, which has been repealed, I agree, that's odd, but it's still there. Which was services for homeless family and youth. I would imagine that someone who administers that program or its successor program could come in and testify as to what the purposes of the program was. The social worker who testified in this case for the state didn't know what the word SNAP is an acronym. She didn't know what it was an acronym for. She couldn't remember. I think she got it later, but at least when she's first asked, she couldn't remember. The state didn't even try in this trial to prove what the purposes of these programs are. Each one of them has a different purpose that is also conveyed by the plural purposes and their separate listing in the statute. And the state didn't prove its case here. And we ask you reverse Ms. Lightness's conviction.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stockmeyer. Thank you very much, Mr. Butler. The matter is submitted and we will issue our decision within 90 days.